thanks for joining us for this edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we've got some very interesting stuff in store for you for today's podcast. We're going to do sort of a potpourri of some of the news stories of the day, perhaps pick up on some of your questions. By the way, we invite your questions at radioprogram@AOL.com. You can send us questions, and we will endeavor to answer them if they're appropriate for our audience and of general interest. So everybody is abuzz this week about the verdict in the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman shooting case. And everybody's got a different viewpoint of this. It kind of depends on your perspective. The fact remains that a young man is dead, and to the disgruntlement of a lot of people, the shooter has gone free. So depending on your perspective, he had a right to self-defense. I'm talking about Zimmerman. Or alternatively, he was a racist assassin who stalked, targeted, and murdered an innocent young child. I mean, the extremes and poles of opinions certainly are causing a lot of controversy and a lot of bitterness about the outcome of the case. But I'm going to offer you a perspective that is an entirely different perspective, a perspective that has not been aired at all in the conventional media. And I'm not necessarily saying this is the truth about the Zimmerman Trayvon Martin shooting, but it's an interesting perspective nonetheless. And of course, you know, we'll never know. We'll never know what, you know, the truth underlying this tragic episode is. But here it goes. An ex-girlfriend said that Zimmerman had outbursts and sometimes threatened suicide. She suspected it was a result of Accutane, the acne medicine that he took. She said he was, quote, the last person in the world, unquote, that she thought would be involved in such an incident. So different was his personality after he took Accutane. It transformed him from a gentle individual into someone who is suffering from violent bouts of rage. The ex-girlfriend said that she and Zimmerman had had a violent argument when she caught him on a singles dating website, even though they were engaged to be married. So, okay, does that prove positive that Zimmerman was adversely affected by Accutane? But Accutane has a long checkered history in terms of the potential risk of psychological and psychiatric reactions. It's been implicated in a higher incidence of suicide, and that's particularly worrisome since it's often administered to a high-risk group, kids who are teenagers. One of the main causes of death, besides automobile accidents and shootings in those kids, you know, certainly kids in violent neighborhoods are often victims of drive-bys, but suicide is high up in terms of causes of death among young people. And who is it that takes Accutane? Well, young people do. Actually, a congressional investigation was launched when a young man committed suicide, and his father, I believe, was a congressman. And the congressman said, let's do an investigation of Accutane. Well, what ended up happening is that Accutane no longer used for acne because of the very high risk of liability. It caused a lot of other problems. It caused liver damage. It can cause autoimmune changes. What Accutane is, it's a super high dose of vitamin A in a synthetic form. And in the past, complementary physicians gave high doses of vitamin A to patients with acne, but vitamin A has side effects. Well, anyway, they decided to make it into a drug. It's a copycat of vitamin A that's patentable, but such high doses of vitamin A caused all kinds of problems. So so imagine this. I mean, obviously, they weren't going to go there in the Zimmerman case, because he had a more plausible defense. He claims that he was set upon by this 17-year-old who was a big kid, and with his head was violently pounded into the pavement, and in an act of self-defense, he shot the kid. End of story. And the jury bought it, and he was acquitted. And they didn't need to employ a temporary insanity defense. But imagine a different scenario. Say Zimmerman had encountered Trayvon Martin, say in the convenience store where Trayvon was buying some Skittles. And Zimmerman saw the kid at the counter, and in an irrational act of rage, he attacked Trayvon Martin, pulled out his revolver, and shot him dead. Okay, that would have been a real serious problem for Zimmerman, because he couldn't have claimed stand your ground. There was no provocation for him to use his gun. So how might they have ingeniously defended him? Well, maybe, just maybe, they might have reached for an insanity defense based on his use of Accutane. They might have said, well, he wasn't in his right mind. He was his judgment and emotions were clouded by the use of this medication that is known to cause problems. Now, if you don't believe, I mean, it's a far-fetched scenario, and I'm not saying that this is what went down, but if you don't believe that Accutane can cause problems, I'm going to read from you some comments from a popular drug rating site. You can weigh in here with your comments about a medication. Either you can say this medication is the best thing since mom's apple pie, it really cured me of a problem, or you can weigh in with complaints about side effects and problems. And quite a few of the comments here about Accutane on the website askapatient.com are pretty negative. And I'm just going to read you a sampling, but you're going to get the flavor of this. Here it goes. Accutane completely ruined my life. These are just a few of the permanent side effects I have. Dry scalp, eyes, lips, sinuses, and skin, pressure, headaches, joint and muscle pain, severe back pain, and severe depression. If you value your health, stay away from this poison. And I'm quoting. Here's one. I was given Accutane for folliculitis. That's chronic boils that failed to respond to all other treatments. My inner sense of well-being was completely destroyed. I could not sit still without panicking. I lost the ability to be happy about anything or to sense any enjoyment or sense of well-being at all. I have never in my life experienced the type of anxiety and depression that I experienced when on this drug. If I had knowledge of my experience before I took this drug, I would never have taken it at all. I want nothing to do with Accutane at all. So you're beginning to get the picture that this medication can have profound side effects. This person says, do not take this drug. Accutane has ruined my life. 3 months after stopping, hair began shedding like crazy. My skin has become like a kabuki mask. I am suicidal. That doesn't even begin to describe how depressed I feel. Severe dry mouth. Roche, I hope you burn in hell for eternity. My life has been robbed from me, and I had a great one before this medication. Another person writes, changed my life forever, physically and spiritually. All I got to say is F this drug, and I hope no one takes it. We can go on and on. Another person writes, and I'm just reading these things off the website. It caused anger problems. I got more violent and moody than ever. I never had a mood problem before taking Accutane. It has been over a year, and that problem has still not worn off. I would rather have dealt with the acne than have anger problems for the rest of my life. So another person writes, it is much better to have acne rather than living horribly due to the side effects. And on and on and on it goes. So, you know, I mean, what I'm saying is obviously provocative. Could Zimmerman have been suffering from Accutane-related anger and impulsiveness, leading him to be more edgy and more aggressive and more prone to stalk Trayvon Martin? Who knows? But given the track record of Accutane, it's entirely plausible that his otherwise placid personality, I mean, you see him and he looks like a gentle giant. He looks like he couldn't harm a fly. But maybe under the influence of Accutane, he turned into an angry, homicidal monster who then pulled the trigger too precipitously on Trayvon. We'll never know the truth about this, but hey, it's a different perspective, and nobody in the mainstream media is talking about it. This story comes to us from Denmark. Marathon woman crosses the finish line. Annette Fredskov of Næstved has completed 366 marathons in 365 days. Now, for most of us, running a marathon would be a peak or pinnacle achievement. But for 41-year-old Annette Fredskov of Næstved, it's just another day because this last Sunday, Fredskov completed a full year in which she ran a marathon, get this, every single day. All right, that's 26 miles every single day, regardless of the weather or her state of exhaustion. And this is amazing. On the final day, she upped the ante and ran two just to commemorate her feat. She did an 84-kilometer race in 10 hours and 44 minutes. Her cumulative mileage was 15,000 kilometers as she completed 366 marathons in 365 days. To perform this feat, she ran through 20 pairs of running shoes over the course of a year. But wait, as they say in the infomercials, there's more. Because if that wasn't impressive enough, I mean, she's a 41-year-old, and for some people, that's the time when they're going from the active lifestyle to the sports medicine doctor's office or to the orthopedist. Wait, there's more, because if doing it just, you know, in and of itself wasn't impressive enough, she's done it all with multiple sclerosis. She describes herself on her website as a normal woman, mother, and wife. She was diagnosed with MS 3 years ago, but instead of letting that daunt her, she decided she could outrun the disease. She says, quote, 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and today I have, without any medication, no problems or symptoms of MS. I believe that running marathons has played a large role in the fact that I am healthy today. She wrote on her website, 2 years ago, I thought the same thing most people think. Running a marathon isn't healthy. A marathon is damaging to the body, and it takes a long time to recover. I have now changed my mind. Marathons are the best thing that have happened to my body and soul. Here's the thing. I got to say, when it comes to patients with MS, and I treat a fair number of them, this is not something that I would casually recommend, because MS patients, I mean, it's tough enough running a marathon. MS patients suffer from muscle weakness. They have muscle degeneration in some cases. They have nerve problems which don't allow them to sense with a sense of proprioception where their footfall is going. And in addition, a lot of MS patients report that when they overexert, particularly in the heat, their symptoms are worse. So I got to say, this lady, she's amazing and determined, and maybe she had a very mild case of MS, but for the vast majority of MS patients, maybe this isn't such a good idea. There was one lady who used to be the last finisher in the New York City Marathon. She would finish in like 19 hours or some, you know, usual finisher. When I did it in 4 hours. She did it in 19 hours, but she had MS, and she relentlessly did the marathon year in, year out. And I thought, and she was pretty severely affected. I saw the way she walked, and she would sort of jog, walk the marathon, and it was painful to see. And I just thought to myself, why do this when the potential for injury or just, you know, breakdown is very great? But here's what they say on the MS website. They have an official position on exercise, as they do on a variety of topics. They say, in addition to being essential to general health and well-being, exercise is helpful in managing many MS symptoms. Now, what they're talking about is not talking about doing a marathon every day. They're just talking about exercise. And I urge all my MS patients to get physical therapy or to do mild to moderate exercise, because there's a tendency for the muscles to weaken. The nerves are not activating the muscles, and you want to keep your muscles strong to maintain balance and to reduce the potential to accumulate body fat. Muscle is one of your best bulwarks against metabolic problems like insulin resistance, which can curtail your longevity and mess up your overall health outlook. It says those patients who participated in an aerobic exercise program, this is patients with MS, had better cardiovascular fitness, improved strength, better bladder and bowel function, which is an issue, and less fatigue and depression. And those are certainly issues in MS. And, you know, look, MS patients are battling depression because, A, it sucks to have a challenging disease, and, B, there's a peculiar type of MS-related depression that occurs because MS affects the brain, and yes, it affects the nerves, the sensory nerves, so that you get tingling, numbness, loss of sensation, and also the motor nerves, so that you get weakening. But it also may affect parts of the brain that are associated with mood. So there is often an MS form of depression, and yes, exercise helps to alleviate depression. And via exercise, you can attain a more positive attitude. This is from the MS website. And increased participation in social activities, which combats isolation. Since 1996, several additional studies have confirmed the benefits of exercise in MS. Yada, yada, yada. A disclaimer, though. An exercise program needs to be appropriate to the capabilities and limitations of the individual and may need to be adjusted as changes occur in MS symptoms. A physical therapist experienced with the unique and varied symptoms of MS can be helpful in designing, supervising, and revising a well-balanced exercise program. Any person with MS who's initiating a new exercise program should also consult with his or her physician before starting. And here's the important caveat for MS patients. Periods of exercise should be carefully timed to avoid the hotter periods of the day and prevent excessive fatigue. All right? Well, certainly that's not something that our friend in Denmark did, because she just went right into the teeth of overexertion and overheating, and she seemed to be okay. With some guidelines, a good exercise program can help to develop the maximum potential of muscle, bone, and respiration, thereby avoiding secondary complications and gaining the benefits of good health and well-being. So here's what I have to say about this, is for every activity, whether it's eating, you know, because you have the hot dog contest, right, you know, in Coney Island, and exercise. You have the people who, at the age of 75, climb Mount Everest. Okay, an amazing feat at any age. You have the people who aren't content to do marathons. They do double and triple marathons. You have the people who, unlike me, I do ordinary triathlons. They don't do just triathlons. They do Ironman triathlons. Those people are great. And if you're one of them, God bless you. But those people are there to incentivize us to do whatever it is that we can do to maintain our health. And you have to find your proper comfort zone. Push yourself a little bit, but don't make yourself sick. Don't get yourself injured. Don't put your life and limb, body and brain in jeopardy with overzealous exercise. You got to find out what works for you and go for it. You know, if you feel like you're that Danish woman, 41-year-old Annette Fredskoff with MS, and you want to go for it, go for it. But pay attention to the signals that your body gives you, because no pain, no gain is not always the best guideline for a healthy exercise program. Spare the rod, spoil the child. That's what they say. But Actually, there is evidence from an article that I'm reading by Sanjay Gupta, who's the medical editor of MedPage. He writes a column called The Gupta Guide, highlighting the relationship between physical punishment in childhood and adult obesity and heart disease. You know, we're expending a lot of effort getting kids to eat better, and those efforts sometimes are thwarted by kids who are picky eaters. Lots of healthy meals are being thrown into trash cans in schools. And so, you know, one wonders, will government efforts at curbing the epidemic of obesity ultimately pay off? Here's an association that is a little bit unexpected. Children who are punished physically at higher risk for cardiovascular disease, arthritis, and obesity in adulthood, researchers in Manitoba, Canada, have found. Compared with adults who were not punished physically as children, I'm quoting from Dr. Sanjay Gupta's article, those who received harsh physical punishment in childhood, and remember that term, harsh physical punishment, those who received harsh physical punishment in childhood were 24% more likely to be obese. They were 35% more likely to have arthritis, according to the researchers of the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. Now, what we have to take a look at is, what does that mean? Harsh physical punishment. And it turns out that harsh physical punishment is more like a systematic beating and not just a corrective slap on the butt or smack on the cheek. I must admit, you know, as a kid, my parents were old school. And I didn't get, savagely or systematically beaten. But when I did something that was out of line, they would correct me, sometimes in a physical way. And no, I wasn't mauled, beaten, or abused. But that really got my attention. And to give you an idea, the presence of physical punishment was lower than that of child maltreatment. Child maltreatment was 3.6 versus 38.1. And so when we talk about physical punishment, according to the definition of the study, and I'm not sure what, you know, why one-third of children in the study were considered maltreated. It all kind of depends on the definition of the researcher. But actually, it was fairly uncommon in this particular study. Less than 4% of these kids were actually physically punished, as opposed to maltreatment, which might involve verbal or psychological abuse. So what they're saying here is that there could be a relationship between hitting and changes in what's called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. How does that occur? Well, if kids are under constant stress and apprehension, they may produce more stress hormones. Stress hormones can affect the heart. They can also, high levels of cortisol may be associated with holding fat around the belly. That's a common theory about obesity, at least one of them, probably many ways that people get overweight. But high levels of stress and cortisol can hold belly fat around your midsection, and therefore there may be a hormonal relationship when people are under the kind of stress that you encounter when you get beaten or hit. This article actually attracted some controversy because in an accompanying editorial in the journal Pediatrics, reviewers found the author's conclusions about physical punishment to be lacking, particularly in their use of harsh physical punishment as the target in the association. So, you know, harsh physical punishment bears little relationship to using occasional corporal punishment in dealing with kids. I know it's very controversial among parents. Some patients have a total non-hit rule. And I understand that because, hitting begets hitting. and you don't want your kid to perpetuate it from generation to generation or take it out in the schoolyard. But this study by no means proves that you should never, ever even consider laying a light hand on your kid, because otherwise your kids are going to become, an obese whale. But it does suggest that there certainly is a relationship between how you treat your kid and how they're going to turn out. But we already know psychologically there are serious longstanding wounds, and there may also be physical consequences, higher incidence of cardiovascular disease, obesity, and inflammatory disorders like arthritis. So, be consistent with your kid, be patient, correct your kid in a way that will get your kid's attention, but don't let it rise to the threshold of harsh physical punishment, because that's going to give them a 24% greater likelihood of becoming obese adults. And think of the psychological consequences as well. Let's turn to some questions from our listeners or from Facebook friends. By the way, if you have a question, you can email us your question to radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com is also the place you email if you want a subscription to our great newsletter. It comes out about once a week, and I usually comment on some important story or stories of the day, and you can get that delivered to your mailbox, your email box, simply by requesting the newsletter at radioprogram@AOL.com. But John is one of my Facebook friends, and he writes, Doc, here's a question for your podcast. I had a colonoscopy about 5 years ago. Afterward, I felt like I had short-term memory loss. I would be thinking about something and suddenly forget what I was just thinking about. The problem persisted, and I'm not entirely sure it has gone away. I have blood in my stool and would like to get a new colonoscopy, but I'm worried about another negative anesthesia side effect. Is it possible to get a colonoscopy without anesthesia, or are there safer forms of anesthesia that I can request? Well, this is an interesting and perplexing question. Of course, anesthesia sometimes causes temporary amnesia. And that, however, is usually temporary and transient. Usually that occurs when you get general anesthesia, as when you get a more extensive type of surgery. They really put you out with either inhaled anesthesia or some kind of intravenous anesthesia, and you're really completely under. Usually, when you get a colonoscopy, that's not the type of anesthesia that's given. You're given a lighter form of anesthesia, which is easily reversed. In fact, one of the types of popular anesthetics that's used is called Versed, because it's easily reversed. You can get a quick injection of the antidote to it, and you come out of it quickly. And no, it's really not such a great idea to get a colonoscopy without anesthesia. It's, pretty uncomfortable. But I guess that is an option, probably not a very good option. I think it's something worth discussing with the gastroenterologist, because under the circumstances, when you get a colonoscopy, unless you're a very high-risk patient, you're not going to get a separate doctor administering anesthesia. Usually, when you do surgery, there is a surgeon present, and then there's an anesthesiologist present. The surgeon does his or her thing, and the anesthesiologist does his or her thing to keep you under during the surgery, and they're part of a team. When you get a colonoscopy, it's often done as an outpatient, and this can be done in the office of the doctor performing colonoscopy, or in an outpatient setting, maybe in a hospital annex. You don't necessarily have to be admitted to the hospital. It's a day procedure. So I would ask for the anesthetic Versed. It's a light anesthetic. It's easily reversed. A bit of a concern, and I don't want to alarm you here, and I don't know the circumstances, but, you know, one has to be concerned that if there are permanent deficits after anesthesia, that you didn't experience a mini stroke or even a stroke during the anesthesia. That would be more likely if it wasn't just a memory problem, but also a speech problem or weakness on one side of the body that would occur, or visual change, or a problem with balance that would occur right after the anesthesia wore off. I don't think that that's the case. And you say, I have blood in my stool and would like to get a new colonoscopy. I think that that is warranted at the very least. Go to the gastroenterologist or go to a rectal surgeon. And if blood in the stool, if it's bright red blood, it could be coming from a small tear in the rectal area or a hemorrhoid, or it could be coming from further up. It's not something to be trifled with. It usually requires some investigation. Even though the usual interval for colonoscopies in low-risk individuals, they're extending it longer and longer. Sometimes, you know, in the past they said, oh, everybody should get a colonoscopy every 3 to 5 years. Well, that's not really the case. If you've had one or two normal colonoscopies at five-year intervals, studies now show that you're at very low risk for developing colon cancer in a short period of time, in less than 8 or 10 or 12 years. The guidelines, I think, are going to be extended longer and longer to prevent overuse of colonoscopies as we literally try to save our sinking medical system. Unnecessary procedures burden the system. They don't yield a lot of good results. They inconvenience patients. And, you know, this, however, is an exception. You've got blood, and sometimes that merits additional investigation to see what the source of the blood is. Keep in mind that if it's bright red blood, it's a little less concerning than if you have tarry stool or maroon blood, which is more likely to come from higher up, from your stomach or from further up in your intestine where a cancer may lurk. But bright red blood is always a reason to get checked out by a rectal surgeon or a gastroenterologist. And perhaps a sigmoidoscopy will suffice. Some studies suggest that sigmoidoscopies actually capture the majority of colon cancers. There is another alternative, but it's fairly invasive, and that is what's called a CT angiogram. I'm sorry, a CT colonoscopy or a virtual colonoscopy. However, the advantages of that are not that well established because they're less accurate at picking up cancers. They still involve you having to get lie down on a table and have air insufflated in your rectum. And in addition, you're exposed to a fairly high amount of radiation during the CT scanning. So in the past, I've held out great hope for this procedure to replace the more invasive colonoscopy. But so far, the advantages have not outweighed the disadvantages. It's still a fairly uncomfortable procedure, although you don't have to have a tube stuck up you. You still have to have a small short tube introduced into your rectum, literally to inflate it with air so that they can see the structures within the intestine via the CT scan. So there you have it, John. You know, listen to the podcast. I hope that you pay some attention to the advice that I'm handing out to you. And I think it's a good teaching moment for the rest of our Intelligent Medicine Podcast listeners. Okay, we can endlessly debate global warming and the need for carbon credits or restriction of the use of fossil fuels in an effort to slow the devastation of our planet that some people claim will happen as our oceans warm up and as our temperatures go up. It certainly is hot here in New York this weekend, but that doesn't necessarily prove that we are inexorably moving towards a warmer climate due to man-made carbon emissions. Some people claim that that's settled science. Other people dispute it. We can go on and on. But one thing that we need to certainly pay attention to is global air pollution. That's something that I can really get down with, regardless of what you think about fossil fuels and pipelines and whether we should close down coal plants. You got to pay attention to this statistic. 2 million deaths yearly worldwide are linked to air pollution. And we got to say that air pollution is actually a little better in the United States than it once was. I remember growing up in Southern California in the smog basin of Los Angeles, where air pollution was really horrendous. I mean, we could feel it when we took a deep breath. On hot days where the air was stagnant, you could barely see to the horizon. And you could feel it. You could feel it burning your lungs. So we are taking measures to curtail air pollution in this country. Of course, China and certain parts of the third world, much worse. I mean, I see pictures sometimes from places like Singapore and China and Indonesia and even some of the developing cities of Africa. And there's this permanent, horrible haze that's hanging over the landscape because there's virtually no government controls over pollution. Some people who are radical libertarians say we should shut down the Environmental Protection Administration. Well, think again, because if we didn't have some controls in place, I mean, I'm not saying that potentially they may be overreaching with regulations in some cases, but if we didn't have environmental controls in place, we would have a much dirtier environment, and that would directly impact our health. Exposure to particle pollution has been linked with early death from heart and lung disease. And lung cancer is also a distinct risk associated with air pollution. This study found that 475,000 deaths yearly are linked with human sources of ozone. Okay, ozone is produced by cars, factories, and ozone is particularly a dangerous substance when it combines with airborne pollutants. So let's think about the quality of our air. And one thing that I speculate on is that, you know, a lot of people say that the United States will be surpassed by many countries of the world, developing countries. I think they've got some big problems looming because they're way behind the curve in terms of curtailing and regulating environmental pollutants. And they've unleashed all kinds of horrible chemicals into their soil, water, and air. And they have undeveloped health systems. We're talking countries like China, Brazil, countries that, you know, we look to as India, we look to them as potential competitors going forward in the 21st century. But unless they cope with these serious environmental challenges, they're really going to fall by the wayside because their healthcare bills and the drain on productivity caused by severe environmental pollution will prevent them from taking that great leap forward into prosperity and world preeminence. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.